Welcome everyone, James McLean here with the seventh in this series of podcasts based on the second season of Doctor Who, second series of Doctor Who as we call it over here, with the return of Russell T. Davis and Shuti Gatwa. For the seventh episode, which is Wishworld, I have with me my esteemed colleague who you'll have heard on adjacent podcasts that we've done, our great friend John Kenneth Muir, who is stateside. So it's always great to have that sort of transatlantic conversation. Not the first in the series, but certainly no more, certainly not the least. John, how are you doing?
I am doing well, and it is so nice to be with you, James. Thank you for having me on the show to discuss Doctor Who. Very excited. Yeah,
years and years ago, when we were first talking, I used to do these really long, elaborate introductions. Someone reminded me of that. And now I seem to have trouble even stringing together what the hell this podcast is. I suppose age and laziness are part and parcel of that. But anyway, so yeah, so John, I mean, John has written, if you don't know John, we very occasionally do a podcast together, which we've done through Casterbris on sort of cult fiction, really, cult fiction. And we've had a longer relationship because we worked together and chatted around Millennium when we used to work around Millennium a long time ago, the TV show, which was born from the X-Files to some degree. But here we are. John's written on Doctor Who. John has blogged on Doctor Who. John knows his Doctor Who.
Oh, thank you for saying that.
Saying that, I'm going to out you that you hadn't watched much of this series, though, had you?
No, I mean, I hate to admit it. You know, before we discussed doing this, I had really not come back to it. And it's not for any reason necessarily to do with the series, but to do with me. I will say that last decade, I was very happy and lucky. You know, my son was young. My wife loves Doctor Who, and all of us watched, you know, the whole, we watched together David Tennant through some of Jodie Whittaker, and then it was like the pandemic happened. And then my son grew up, and this sounds ridiculous, but I had a hard time going back to it without him, because like we did like the whole thing. Like we had that, he had the toys, you know, he had the TARDIS interior, you know, we had Cybermen and Daleks, and you know, it was just it was just an amazing experience sharing that with him when he was in kindergarten. And you know, and we just binged them all, and you know, went through, you know, that we lived in Doctor Who for several years, and then again the terrible thing happened. He grew up and I stayed a kid, you know, that's it. You know? And so it's like, oh, so there was always this thing like, I can't go back to Doctor Who now because my son won't be with me. And you know, so my wife and I started watching season two, and I have to admit we both kind of had lumps in our throat. The theme song kicked in, the intro kicked in, and the TARDIS kicked in, and it was And we kind of felt this, you know, emotional connection to, you know, maybe 10, oh, could have longer than that, 13 years ago, you know, when we began, you know, doing all that and began that. So that was a very long-winded answer. But yes, I had kind of left Doctor Who, not because of the show. I was aware of what's going on, the cooperation with Disney. You know, so the first thing that struck me was like, oh, my God, look at the special effects. This is different, right? You know, look at these robots and the venue for the singing contest, and you know, the special effects, all the people in the singing contest getting thrown into space, you know, like, wow, holy cow, we've sort of taken a leap forward in production value and special effects. But
a colleague of mine who was on a previous week was saying that apparently of that money that they get from Disney, 80% of it goes on advertising. So oh, there's only like a 20% bump on the actual quality in theory. And 80% is trying to. But yeah, I'd throw that in there. It's interesting.
Wow.
So You've watched all of this. Did you say you've watched all the series so far? You didn't cherry
Yes,
pick.
yes.
You went through
So
the
I
whole lot.
started with Robot Revolution and went right through to Wish World, which was the last one that was available. Yeah.
So do you want to just give us a little talk about your feelings coming up to this point, since you've watched them all in quite quick succession from 1 to 7?
So what struck me about it is it does feel like a very different show. Now, granted, it's been a while for me. You know, that some things are very familiar and some things are very different. You know, and of course we live in a different time with different requirements for streaming. So what I was kind of struck with, and listen, I'd love to know what you think as well and tell me if I'm way off, but what kind of struck me watching it was there were so many great ideas. Like there seemed to be a fascinating idea coming up almost every 10 minutes, but I felt like none of the ideas, forgive me, were handled particularly deeply. It was like, here's this great idea that robots don't pick up every ninth word. And I thought that's like a brilliant notion that really could have been sussed out maybe in previous generations to a whole story. But that was just like part of a rotating sequence of ideas. So the ideas are strong, but I felt like the actual episodes felt very undercooked and that I didn't and that I had a little bit of trouble with them. It was almost like they had been constructed, and who could blame them, to get your attention, realize you're going to be on your phone for a while, and then get your attention with the next great idea. Because some of the ideas were fantastic. The idea of the in the well, the creature behind you, another fantastic, like great Doctor Who idea. Certainly, you know, again, forgive me for saying this, if that's as great as the ideas in Blink, right? You know, for a like fascinating idea, but again, not much done with it. It felt to me like they like a succession of strong ideas, but not great execution. So my wife and I felt this that, for instance, the story Lux with Mr. Ring-a-Ding, was that it? A great concept. And then we get into this moment where there are Doctor Who fans who help him. But they're there for literally 2 minutes and or something like that. And then we're expected to really feel for them that they're not real. And it's like, but we spent no time with them. But that 2 minutes was supposed to carry like sort of all of the emotions of the story. And it's like, but sometimes I was telling you know, again, my wife and I, we take walks and we were talking about this. And you know, it's one of those things, it's almost like learning Spanish. Can you learn Spanish quickly? Or another language quickly, you can, but also you need to actually have time with the language and let that thought process of the language kind of sink in with you. And I said, you know, with doc these stories, we spend so little time with these characters like this, these guest characters, like again in the well, the officer who sacrificed themselves. Again, and that was supposed to carry so much of the emotionality of the story, but we spend so little time, like just l literally. Very little time with them in the story that somehow it felt undercooked to me. So I kept seeing that again and again. Great ideas, but we're rushing to get to whatever this line that's easily digestible so we can look up for our phones. It's like you always have hope. That's the through line that we get a little canned line about hope in every episode. So
But there is truth to that. There is, in terms of writing, there is often awareness in writing rooms that, and there is a term for it, and the terms escape me, but where, yes, that they're aware that people will be dual reading, essentially, reading this TV screen or their monitor, reading their phone. And how do you keep people on board when you've no longer got their attention? So this is a legitimate thing, isn't it?
it absolutely is, and that's again, you know, just to keep bringing up my wife because we've been watching it all week and having these talks and how is it hitting us? How is it striking us now? And it strikes me as something that is intentional and that we're in a very different era of how we experience media and entertainment. So I can't really blame them for this. Because again, the ideas are clearly there. I mean, some stunningly good ideas that just, are very exciting and interesting. And you think that's a great idea, but then nothing happens with it, and the show kind of goes fallow for a couple minutes, and then like the next great idea comes up, and you're locked in again, and then nothing really happens with that, and then we kind of get the emotionality. And listen, I'm cued in enough with fans, like some people saying that this doctor cries a lot, and he does, and I'm not making any political assessment about that, but I'm saying yes, like I feel like that's part of this. It's like, well, he's never been that emotional, but if you're only like coming in and out, right, you kind of, I guess you need that to try to sort of make it really engaging. So,
Did you watch the first season of Shooties?
I have to be absolutely clear. I did not. And Kadmar, I was like, oh,
Okay, fine.
we didn't see him regenerate. And I said, no, because James, total honesty, we talked about a week ago and I said, well, I'm not caught up. How should I catch up? So I just decided to do the whole second season. Again, I'm aware enough to know about by generation, right? And how David Tennant came back. So I'm steeped in it enough to know what happened, but I definitely know, again, to be clear to all the listeners, I did not watch his first season. I know who Ruby is, right? Things like I'm in that enough to know, but no, I landed in the second season and just started going. So if I've missed something, please do tell me that, absolutely.
So something which I noticed on Instagram, because I've been following some of the sort of main official accounts and just looking below the line and seeing what people are saying. And certainly this episode is the first episode where I've seen what I call the haters being back. Now, those, I
Oh
don't mean people
dear.
who don't like the show, but like the story, but those who sort of say, well, this is why it's about to get cancelled, or it's about time, this is proof, that sort of people, they started to come
Right,
in with this episode. I think we'll talk a bit
right,
about that.
right. Oh,
But
they
what,
exist. Yeah.
oh, the, always exist, but they've been quite quiet so far this season, especially compared to last series as well, has been very positive in those comment sections. Every episode has been pretty much strongly received. This one less so, but what I thought was interesting in
Really?
this one, there was a lot of people talking about the return of Omega and people starting to make a sort of trajectory points of Davis's writing, where each season that Davis writes, he tends to bring back someone from the canon. And
Right.
there's an argument here that this isn't, someone was saying, well, this isn't really for, he said this is for new fans, but it feels like it's for old fans. And I wondered, what do you feel? Do you feel that as an, and again, I suppose I'm thinking about this from you because, as you say, you're like a partially new audience to this.
Right.
Do you feel like when Omega's mentioned in this, or the like, do you feel that it does feel like if you were a new fan that you'd feel like you are outside of a conversation, or do you feel that it's set up within the story enough that when these things pop up, that they feel digestible and that as a newer fan than people say 40 years old and older, that this is their place?
So for me, I always love the callbacks and the returns, but again, you do have to realize I am like, historically deeply steeped in it. So my wife, she's watched it all, but so I assume I'm allowed to, you've mentioned who comes back and things like that. So I'm not putting in any spoilers that anyone will object to. But when the Ronnie came back, she's like, who is that? And I'm like, well, Catherine, you didn't really love the sixth doctor. So you probably don't remember who this was. And then they came back and they appeared in the seventh doctor too. Those aren't her favorite eras and not ones. I mean, I've been watching Doctor Who since the 70s. I introduced it to my wife in the 90s. I wrote the book, so she was with me. And then, like I said, we had the new Who, with my son. So this to her as a new fan, like, didn't land with her at all. She's like, "Who is this? Like, why? What? Why does this matter? Who is that?" She does define herself as a time lady, so fair enough, right? And they give you contextual clues, but I don't think it landed for her the way it did for me, someone who I would say, I'd say I'm more like an older fan, maybe a slightly lapsed fan. But I've always felt like it's something I would come back to. For her, I think it felt like, what is this, right?
Yeah, because I
What
think there's
is
always a bit where it's fine and can be fun, where you can drop in Easter eggs where it doesn't matter whether you get them or not. If you
right.
see them, you see them. If you don't, you don't.
Right.
When, like, I know we're going back to the previous episode, when you have this by regeneration, by generation, and she splits,
Yes.
and it's sort of like I am the Rani, you feel like there's a punchline there, that if you're not
Right.
part of that punchline, you feel like you've missed something. That's, I suppose, the concern.
That is. And that's very much what we felt by watching it. You just say, wait, who's this? I mean, it's very similar with Star Trek, I think. Most people who are fans steeped in Star Trek, they love Deep Space Nine. When I watched with my wife, she loved Voyager. And I said, why? And she said, because they're out on their own and they're encountering new people. And I know who they encounter. But on Deep Space Nine, like, so wait, are they fighting with the Cardassians now? Are they fighting with the Klingons? Now they're allies with the Klingons. Now they're allies with the Cardassians. What's going on? It's like almost too much if you're really not steeped in it. And it's so it is funny to see how it relates. I don't think that that landed for people. Maybe who aren't steeped in Doctor Who, because it certainly didn't in my house. I mean, that was just our experience, though. It did for me. It's like, oh, cool. Like, wow. Like, I never thought I would, see that as, the piece of it. Then leading into another piece, from, the Third Doctor's era, right? Which again is great. And I popped up when Carol Foreman appeared. She's like, what? What? Who is that? Right, who is that woman? I'm like, well, she's that. That's from the first doctor. She's like, what?
See, with that one wasn't so bad because you'll have missed it. But I think I can't remember what
Okay.
episode it was last series. They made a couple of
Okay.
conversations about him having a granddaughter and
Okay.
that she was lost. So you feel like if you were a new follower,
You
that
pick
might
that
have
up.
some sort of, yeah, there's a segue there to a previous conversation, previous narrative. But yeah, the Rani, outside of every year, fans seem to assume the Rani is going to be the villain since 2005.
That's right. That's right.
I was almost kind of disappointed that she was, just because it almost validated those fans who've been lusting for some reason after the Rani since then. But
Right.
fair enough. So let's just quickly talk about let's quick let's talk about Wishworld itself. Written by Russell T. Davis. What are your feelings on the actual story itself?
So it, I liked it, and I like when, Doctor Who does stories like this, a world that is wrong, but people don't necessarily realize it and sort of have to come out of whatever, I don't want to say stupor, but it is almost a stupor, right? That they have to come out of this stupor to see that the world is wrong. Okay, so I thought that was very powerful, considering the world we live in now, which is sort of like, an anti-reality in some cases. Like, education is bad, knowledge is bad, alliances that have served us are bad, but what's good are things like tariffs, trade wars, throwing people out of their jobs. It's like we're kind of living in a weird bizarro world. And so the idea of the bizarro world kind of hit, I think, at this point in a way, maybe. And again, forgive me if I don't remember the episode, but I loved, of course, the Matt Smith era. But there was a Matt Smith story where he was in a kind of timeless world, and they were like, it was like all eras together at once, but people didn't have the sense that it was wrong. So it felt like it was related to the tradition of Doctor Who as we know it, but again, picking up on something that is timely now. So I really like it, especially because the veneer was very clearly 1950s, and that's okay. I didn't live in the 1950s, but in terms of media consumption and how we relate to it visually and emotionally, it's an era of conformity where people were hidden if they were at all different from the norm, and so like this idea of doubting the world. I thought was very powerful. I thought it was really interesting that they picked the 1950s world because, of course, here in America, that's this sort of mythical time that the right wing always wants to go back to. Everything was great in the 50s, they say. Leave It to Beaver, Father Knows Best, you know, basically the white patriarchy astride the world, right? And and everybody else is sort of sublimated beneath that, right? Of course, what they don't say is that like taxes were incredibly high. That's how the middle class was created, right? They don't want that part of it. They just want the social part of it. So sort of creating that kind of, conformist world. And again, where like you're reporting somebody who's different, who has doubts. I really like that. I think that that was actually. For me, this was one of the stronger stories where I felt like I was engaged throughout. That it wasn't sort of pop. I was calling it like drop in, drop out. It didn't. I felt more engaged all along. And when the doctor said that a man is beautiful, and everyone kind of stopped, you can't say that. I thought, yeah, exactly, right,
Yeah,
right.
there's a sort of narrative around the 50s which you've hit on the head there, where especially in television, it carries a very nostalgic, and it's obviously, as you say, very much a space where certain people of a certain political persuasion see as being almost like the ultimate point of civilization. And it always frustrates me. There's a show over here, I don't know if you've seen it, the Father Brown,
No, I have not.
which is based on the books, the detective books of a detective priest. In the books, they were set earlier, but they set them in the TV show in the 1950s. I think, again, for this reason, that it has this notion of being the perfect civilization. And the problem I have with Father Brown, which is a quite enjoyable, fun, middle of the day filler to detective show, is that it embodies it, embeds it with a lot of progressive sort of kind of cultural norms, which it challenges through its main character. So through them and through stories, it will challenge that in a way that you knew in the 1950s it wouldn't be challenged. And in a
Right.
sense, it almost validates, or I don't know, actually validates this notion that the 50s was a perfect civilization, that yes, it was, a very masculine white culture, but when there's problems, people would actually address them and confront it, and
Right.
then the right outcomes would occur. And it's like, well, no, that's not how it was, and we kind of
That's
almost
right.
distorting history through this. And this episode didn't really do that. It was almost trying to challenge that a little bit. So yeah, I get you that. I didn't enjoy it that much though. I
Oh, really?
of the
Okay.
whole of the series so far, Lux I found a bit bland. I think it was Rick. Was it Rick or was it James? One of our previous guests was no saying it's very much like Tooth and Claw, which I can
Right.
sort of see in a framework. It did feel like I'd seen that sort of thing before. I really enjoyed the rest. This one, I think if it was an anthology show like Black Mirror, I'd have found this far more engaging. But when I sort of knew that I was waiting for, or I knew that would come, and I was waiting for the status quo to return, I found
Right.
myself at this point in the series, especially when so many questions had been charged up in the previous story, sort of frustrating rather than enjoyable. The production of it was good. As I say, the ideas were there. The large bone beasts walking across London was, beautifully creative.
Right.
What you're saying, the way it was addressing these sort of 50s concepts was great, but ultimately I wanted the status quo to occur, because I felt like this was going to be something which ultimately was going to lead to not much, and in the end it didn't really deliver much satisfaction for me. There was
I
yeah I
do
didn't feel
understand that.
satisfied.
James, this is very interesting. So it may depend on what kind of storytelling you like and what kind of storytelling you like in Doctor Who. Because for me, I mean, listen, I'm if you're talking about serialization or standalone stories, like I'm a standalone kind of guy. So for me, like watching this season, I feel like the way it serializes, it's like you tell a standalone story, and then at the end, the old woman shows up, right? And like that's the only thing that triggers you between that keeps it all together. So for me, it's like, no, I kind of like these what if one-off scenarios, and I really like dive into that. Like again, I've just been really for me, sort of grooving on these ideas and wishing there were time to get into them a little bit more. Again, like I loved the ideas in the well, even though that's a very familiar setup for Doctor Who. You end up on some distant planet where something's going on. It's often a mining planet, it seems like to me, like, or something like Water of Mars or something like that, right? You know, and then there's something horrible and ancient there that is, you know, going to rise up. So very familiar story, but I just love the idea of the thing behind you that you can't see, but you know is there. I loved it. Great idea. Again, Robot Revolution, I loved the every nine word thing. Like, just, so for me, it's like those concepts are strong and I'm okay with that. And for me, coming back to it, maybe because I missed the first season, like that's sort of more how I associate with Doctor Who. Like, what is where are we this week? And I find very much that I don't need the serialization to some extent, right? So it might be very much what you're looking for. Like, to me, it's like, oh, okay, you know, I don't know. I don't find myself really wanting that much here. Whereas, no, I'm looking for things like, how is Doctor Who updating its standards, its familiar stories to the now and this era? How is it doing it now? For instance, again, what I talked about in my book is that, you know, there's a large percentage of Doctor Who stories from the very beginning in the original series till now. I mean, it's some ridiculous percentage that I put in my book where it's the Doctor lands and there are two fighting factions and he has to take a side and then you know, which faction are you going to be with? And then sort of, you know, brings that conflict to resolution. And you know, the fun for me in Doctor Who is like, how did Tom Baker do that? How did William Hartnell deal with that? How did Jodie Whittaker deal with that? So it's like, oh yeah, like I want to see the new Doctor go through those things, even though I'm sort of familiar with the story. Like, what new concepts are they bringing to that story? You know, and, you know, AI versus Al for Al. And I thought that was kind of funny, right? And a surprise for me. So I didn't find myself wanting to get through that world. I kind of want to see, how does this Doctor, how does this companion now in 2025 reckon with this? And what is that world telling us about now? What is the social commentary? And I felt like it gave me all that. I am sort of baffled, and I haven't read any of those comments, again, total honesty, that this would be the one that haters would come back for, right? Because
yeah,
it didn't seem offensive to me, like in any, like what was not to like about it? I don't know. So tell me, James, what was it for you that was?
I was just, I think, I mean, you watched WandaVision as well, didn't you?
Yes.
I mean, this felt, the beats it was playing, I think I felt I'd seen this already played out. So, and again, Doctor Who has done that many times, and that's not to say that's right. A problem for it. But,
right.
And again, my problems with it, I think, and I read on the social media comments, outside of the haters, the people who were critical about it were kind of in the same space, which was like, I just didn't give me anything. I suppose it's almost like you've been given a meaty meal and then you're expecting the nice dessert and you're given a starter or something. It just felt the placing of it at this point when it was accelerating towards something and then you break out of this. Now, we know this is a very conventional tactic for storytelling. When you keep people hungry for a little bit, you don't feed them straight away. You don't give in to what they want. You pull them along. And I suppose with eight episodes in a season, it just felt a little, the pace push just felt a little too far left field for me to actually, I was like, yeah, I'm okay. He's in this. I think when you sort of see the beginning, you're okay. You read the room straight away. You go, right. They're all stuck in a fantasy world of some sort. We don't know how. We don't know why. Right. He's going to be like this for a while, but soon enough, he's going to start working it out. Maybe she will. We don't know. Oh, here comes Ruby. Of course she knows. What a surprise. Being very much a Rose archetype of this generation, that she would have some added insight. And then at the end, when you get this long sort of spiel of I'm the Rani and now you will remember, and it seems to take him so long to remember. And I don't know. I know what he was doing, and I don't think what it was doing was bad. So I think it's the difference, again, because you say it comes from your perspective. It's not about sort of quite, it's about your own qualification on the show rather than the show's actual sort of quantitative value of
Right.
entertainment. For me, I came out of it feeling unsatisfied, but I was also aware that that doesn't necessarily mean that the show has done anything wrong. It's just from how
Right.
my coming in, I felt unsatisfied. And I also, just to be clear, I don't like serialized storytelling. I was quite disappointed this series that when they've done finally what I've asked for so many years on this podcast, which is to get away from the backpacking companion who's dipping in and out of watching atrocities and finding them kind of cool, going back to mum for some food, heading back out to see another atrocity and finding it fun. Someone who actually just wants to get home and he's got to get her home, that idea which they pushed in its promo packs, can you get her home? I was quite excited about it. But when it sort of became structured in a way that, say, Davison wasn't, Davison needed to get Tegan home, but it was almost like an afterthought at the beginning of each episode. The scanner would go up and she'd go, "That's not Heathrow Airport," and he'd go, "Oh yeah, that's yeah, I blow, here we go." But in this, it was, having that I can't remember what it's called, the validate, the device punctuated in
The
each episode just ties everything in a way I
scaffolding.
don't want.
Right.
Yeah, the scaffolding. And I don't want, this
Scaffolding.
show does not need scaffolding. That's the whole point of Doctor Who. In my
I
mind, Doctor
agree.
Who should be scaffoldless. It should be someone sort of landing in a place and them having to come to terms to learn and understand about it as the audience does. And then you go off to another almost anthology-like story. It's Black Mirror, but with a main character that's attached to all of them.
That's very much how I see it. And the things you said have given me a couple thoughts that I want to share on different topics there. But I did think so. I do think that the series made a little bit of a mistake in getting Belinda on board so quickly. I really liked in the Robot Revolution, she said, "Hold up, you're dangerous. What are you doing?" And she forgave him and accepted him way too quickly. And that's how my wife felt. She's like, "Wow, I really liked her. This was something new and different in Doctor Who. Someone who didn't immediately drink the Kool-Aid about him." And then an episode later, she drank the Kool-Aid. And I said, "Listen, we've seen this before." I said, "Catherine, do you remember Voyager? Vo Star Trek Voyager? You had the Starfleet crew and the Maquis crew. But by the end of the first episode, the Maquis crew was wearing Starfleet uniforms and all the drama was gone." And Doctor Who absolutely made the same mistake 30 years later. They had the intelligence and foresight to say, "Let's have somebody who's different, who doesn't drink the Kool-Aid, and who's saying, 'Wait a minute, you're dangerous. You're kind of impulsive, and you get into these wild situations, and you don't think about all the repercussions.'" And then they immediately take away her agency in terms
So
of
why
having.
is it that Doctor Who, which I've said recently, is if to me it feels like Doctor Who's biggest problem is it's trapped in its own architecture. Because while you could argue that Turlough didn't fit with the Peter Davison era and the way that they told stories back then, surely the dramatic tension between a Doctor and a Turlough now would be a very fresh thing. But they don't seem to want to go down those paths.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think you said it brilliantly. Like, why not do that? Like, we've seen so many companions who immediately are on board. I mean, the doctor is in some sense like a danger junkie. He's like an extreme bungee jumper or something, and he meets people and he's like, "Bungee jump with me." But it's even worse than that, because it's like bungee jumping, but there are people who, when you jump, who want to kill you when you get down there, before you pull out, right? Right? So it's like, okay, it's even worse, right? It's not just dangerous, but it's all kinds of jeopardies there. And instead of like, they had the foresight to say, "Let's make her somebody different," but then immediately gave it up. And I'm not sure why they would do that. But my other point, which might be 100% contradictory to that, is what you were talking about, sort of the sameness. And I don't know if I come at this from being a literary critic, but I know for me, every time I watch Doctor Who, I'm looking to see how this new version of the character sort of goes through this universe, and how is it different? How is it the same? Like the robot revolution so clearly fits into tradition. And so now I can compare it to the Daleks. I can compare it to, you know, what other story, like how did this doctor handle it, misperform? How, you know, and I create this line of sort of comparison that's very interesting to me as a critic, as a fan, but like it has to have like something familiar. Like so Jodie Whittaker, for instance. So I really like Jodie Whittaker. I have no problems that we had a woman. I very much liked her take on the doctor, but I can tell you, so again, my son, you know, steeped in it. We did everything. We got to her era, and the first year or two of her era, she had no familiar villains. There were no Cybermen. There were no Daleks, right? And my son was like, it's like it's not Doctor Who. We have her, but like we can't conceptualize her in terms of any of the others. They're doing her a huge disservice because they're not showing us how she deals with it. Because how Matt Smith dealt with the Cybermen or how Peter Capaldi did was different than Troughton or Hartnell or whoever, right? And you sort of like over time, because originality is so hard, what are there, 7 stories? All you can do is have those little differences, right? In approach, in character, how they deal with it. And he's like, I don't like Doctor Who now. And it's not because she's a woman, which I think a lot of people, you know, unfairly tagged as the reason. It's because the story, they've put her in a world that doesn't feel like Doctor Who to me, you know? And then of course, later in her run, they did. I feel like they realized they made a mistake. Like, I want to see a woman doctor go up against the Daleks, right? I need to see that for comparison. So maybe it's just a critical thing, you know, a criticism thing, a creative thing, like I'm looking at it in those terms. But for me to get to Wish World and to have that story and to be able to compare it back to other stories, like, yeah, I want to see how this doctor gets out of it. I want to see how this doctor reckons with it. I want to see what it talks about now in 2025. And by that standard, I liked it because I felt like what it was talking about was this fact that we've all been yanked in some ways back to this 1950s mentality. And we're not supposed to say anything. We're not supposed to be bothered by that, right? We're not supposed to doubt that, right? That all these things, all these understandings we've had about how it's a much more nuanced world now than it was in the 1950s, all that's been yanked away and now we're back in 1950s world. So like for me, the metaphor works now with this doctor because it says something about our time that maybe, the Matt Smith one, and I'm so sorry, I can't remember the title. But, you know, Winston Churchill was there, but it was also Rome and there were blimps. You know, at the time, like, that's weird phantasmagoria, but it didn't seem to relate so clearly to our times as Wish World relates
to our absolutely
time right now. So it's like, okay, that's it. That's funny. They found a Doctor Who way of talking about now in a way that is meaningful, but also at the same time, consistent with Doctor Who history. I don't know if I'm making any sense, but.
But I think, I get that. And I think that's a really good point. I liked your bungee jump analogy. And I was just thinking, if I was showrunning this and I was talking to my writers or co-writers, I think I'd use the bungee jump analogy to sort of give an expectant of what we need out of these two characters to make it real. Because it's not just the two of them jumping down, as you said, towards a load of monsters, acceleration, load of monsters. The other factor is that you're jumping down as a companion on with someone, and the doctor's got a far sturdier, far more comfortable rope than you. Yours is like a string. And yet when you both bounce up, you're not annoyed at him about it. Because you kind of feel that if we're talking about 2025 mentality, and I'm also talking about in a certain degree in our expectation of show writing, you feel that that should be in there to some degree. And you say you saw it in the first episode.
Right.
But then in the Interstellar Song Contest one, you almost have it where she sort of says, you're amazing, you're great, but you also scare me. But then at the same time, I was thinking, you know, when he's beating up kid, if you didn't have the holographic shenanigans, essentially he was in the corner continually kicking this guy against the wall with his feet. That's essentially what he was doing. He was brutally assaulting this person for who is invariably a horrible person. And as the writer has said, he always wanted to make sure that kid was not just sort of was not an epitome for the cause of the planet. He was someone who actually kind of enjoyed causing pain. But you've just watched your friend just start laying into a person in the corner, and you sort of the next thing you say to them is, you're unbelievable, but you're a little bit scary. You think that's not the reaction that should be there if that is the analogy there, if that is what is actually going on. And it
Right.
feels to me that Doctor Who since 2005 certainly has always, to some degree, wanted to put the companion on the same level as the Doctor. And yet, invariably, they're not. They're on two different types of bungee cords. And the show never really truly acknowledges that the companion never feels slightly unstabilized by the fact that their utilities in this jump are far less certain and secure as the guy or girl that you're jumping alongside.
Right. And I think the answer for a long part of New Who, I hope that's not a derogatory term, but just for classification, their answer for the vast majority of New Who is to make the companion sort of more superpowered, right? Clara, Rose, even Rory to some extent, being the immortal Sentry, to try to raise them to the same bungee level. I'm not going to go back and relitigate that decision. I understand it, and in those contexts it probably worked, but it does seem like the opportunity now, and it seems like they knew that with Belinda, was to go the absolute other way for someone to be able to stand off. And by the way, it gives her a lot of agency and say, you screwed up, dude. What the hell are you doing? Instead of like immediately going, yeah, let's go bungee jump together. It's like they knew that and then couldn't commit to it, because although she said she was scared in that one, it really bothered my wife watching. I think it was at the end of Lux. It was with that she was like, "You're amazing. You did so great." And she's like, "Wow." She turned really fast from "I'm afraid of you. Get me home" to like, "You're awesome." Right? It's
That's
like, are
it.
we so afraid of interpersonal conflict that we can't maintain that a little bit? Like, I
Because
would be
that
like,
be yeah.
it should have been, what have you done? You have, you've let loose, there's this thing that you've exposed me to that could have killed me. There's been a fire, there's been, God sprouting on earth. What are what have you done? This is not okay. Yeah, it all turned out okay, but it didn't feel okay when he was chasing us, right? It should have been more of that. But again, you get this feeling that they don't really want to reckon with the idea that there'd be somebody like that the Doctor is not a wholly positive character. I think they're afraid to let him be what he clearly and abundantly is. My wife did say after the Hell Yeah, the song contest, she said to me, and she's a psychologist, she said, she was looking, she said, that was good. That was a classic PTSD reaction, right? She said, PTSD, PTSD, that's actually pretty good, John. I was like, yeah, I get it. And she's like, I'm not validating it. I'm just saying that's a classic PTSD reaction. I'm not saying it's right or that he was justified, but classic. And they've been setting that up all along too. Last of the Time Lords, all that stuff. So, I think they know they can go a little more that way, and I think they should lean into it, frankly, with the companion and the Doctor, and to have that, a new kind of chemistry, where they are aware of the bungee jumping and the difference between them, and like, yeah, I don't know, get me home. I don't want to be a part of this.
I
I
mean,
don't
this is
know.
why I always like to have a three. I mean, I go back to, let's say, 1980s, the Dungeons and Dragons cartoon. It'd be nothing without Eric. You'd need that person who is just constantly pushing against the narrative, almost an anti-hero to a degree, but not an anti-hero.
Right.
And I think about, I suppose, what we're talking about here is that how do you keep Doctor Who fresh? And I think also we've got to be mindful that they'll be doing their research in this. They'll be looking, they'll have people looking at audiences, what people are enjoying in the show, what they're not, and that will feed in to the decisions made in the writing of the show. So there's a carefulness not to be too much of a backseat driver here and sort of say, well, clearly they don't know what they're doing. They are aware of a
Absolutely.
market more than we are. And now you've got
For
this
sure.
global, and as you said, this global distribution. And as I've said, I think that is very much tapping into the sort of successes of fantasy tends to have more success, I think, at the moment in today's market than sci-fi. So you're sort of seeing a sort of Stranger Things, Galaxy, Guardians of the Galaxy,
Right.
Witcher, Wednesday, stuff which has got a little bit of fantasy element to it is where the show is pitching itself, and that's probably why.
And see, again, we've been watching it all week. We've been, and then we walk and we talk about what we saw and how we're feeling about it. And I said, Catherine, the Doctor Who I actually grew up with, it was the Hinchcliffe era. That was the WOR TV in the late 1970s, New York. It was Tom Baker. And I said, and it was terrifying. I mean, we're talking about, Planet of Evil, Terror of the Zygons, the Android Invasion, the Ark in Space, where they're eating humans while they're asleep. I said, it was this Lovecraftian universe. And I said, this is a, and that is kind of, to me, how I like Doctor Who the most. I mean, I'm just going to say, and it's not because it's inherently better or worse. It's how I first experienced and how it made me feel, my first introduction to the show. And I said, but this, she said, it's so much more whimsical and almost artificial or theatrical than old Doctor Who. And I said, it is. There's a whimsy here that is not like that era. And I said, but it changes all the time. I said, people loved Douglas Adams. He was a great author, but there was a period where he did Doctor Who, and I hated it. And the reason I hated it was because his idea as an author is that the universe is inherently absurd, and that you can't, there's no point in actually doing anything because it's absurd. And I said, and that's anathema to me, to how I see the Doctor. Because if the Doctor thinks he's in an absurd universe, why help anybody? So it's like, listen, I get it. Like, but if you encounter Douglas Adams' Doctor Who, the Key to Time, whatever, first, you're gonna love that, right? So I agree with you. Like, they must have looked at this and thought, we need to have more whimsy, more fantasy, make it, less, I don't know, scary, less sci-fi, something like that. I mean, it's clear we've gone. It's clear there's been a major shift. Let me just say that, like from the time I left Doctor Who to the time I've returned, right, in these last 10 years, like it's a very different show. And that takes a little bit of getting used to, I think. But the anchor is, again, that I'm now seeing this doctor do the negotiate between two factions story. I'm now seeing this doctor do the you're in a false world story, which, I get the WandaVision comparison, but it really does predate that in Doctor Who. That's like a staple, right? So it's like, even though it's different, even though it's got that whimsy, that fantasy element, there are still things you can hang your hat on and say, yes, it's part of this tradition and sort of a way of telling stories, I guess. But it's definitely different. I mean, it's not Lovecraftian for sure. Even the
No.
well, which seems like it would have been a Lovecraftian thing, is not. I mean,
It
so.
is interesting what different eras we come, because I came from an era, I suppose, a little after you. So for me, Legopolis, sort of Bidmead, moving into the 80s, where it's a lot more sci-fi, Star Wars driven. It's quite nihilistic in some ways and quite cold. There's not much fun going on, and that's where I come from, Doctor Who. But yeah, so just quickly just turn, because we're probably running out of time, already gone for an hour. If we turn our attention to the Rani, so what did you think about the Rani? Because I think people want us to talk about the Rani or the Ranis.
The Ronnie's right.
Rani.
So the performances are fine. Catherine, my wife, asked me, what are you going to say? And I'm saying, I'm not going to criticize any performances. I think everybody's good. I didn't feel like, if she's called the Ronnie, but is I didn't feel anything particularly Ronnie-esque. Is that because of the character or because of the writing? It's like, could this have been anybody? Could this have been any?
Well, this is what interests me when they went for the Rani, because the Rani, certainly when she first appeared in Mark of the Rani, was very much different to the Master. There was a far
Right.
more sort of amoral element to her. There wasn't an evilness. She was interested in her experiments, she was interested in her science, and that was all that mattered. And that sort of
Right.
shifted a little in time with the Rani and by dimensions in time, which I noticed that was a clip of in the montage of the Rani, so maybe it's canon. Who's to
Yeah, but maybe
say?
it is now. That's right.
I like to think it is. I have reasons behind that. But anyway, what is the Rani? And I was interested in that as well. How are you defining this out, especially when you've had Missy?
Right.
How do you make sure this doesn't feel like a female master?
I'm not sure it did because I think that was Catherine's first flux. Again, we love the Peter Capaldi era. We loved the woman master. I thought she, really great, a really fascinating representation of the master. And I think that was her first thought. This is the master. I don't know that it's clearly distinguishable. Like, tell you just described sort of what the subset is. Like, what is the Rani? I'm not sure that, other than having the name and the atavistic, relationship to old Doctor Who, that there was anything very specific about this plan or behavior that cried out for it to be the Rani, right? I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe someone who listens will, tell us, no, that John, you're missing this, and I'm open to that. But that was my gut feeling too, was that we brought this person back. I'm not going to say it's fan service because I think that would be hostile. I mean, I think it's a legitimate choice to bring the Rani back. And like I said, I was super excited when I realized who that was. But then the use they put her to, I thought, well, couldn't she have been the master? Could she have been anybody in Doctor Who history? What did you think, Jane?
Well, I think it's about trying to find the difference between Moriarty and, I don't know, Dr. Frankenstein. You're trying to find, because that's really where you want to position the Rani as someone who is, there's a great experiment, there's a great answer that she wants. And I suppose it will depend on how they do this next week with Omega. Is she there to meet Omega because of power? Is she there to meet Omega because there's a fascination with time and wanting to know something, and then maybe you are moving down a Rani straight. While at the moment, you're right, I think it's very ambiguous, and she, this does have Last of the Time Lords, end of time sort of vibes about the Rani. And yeah, I agree with you on that. I think, I've heard complaints about, why did she bioregenerate? Does that, and I kind of feel like with Legopolis, I always said that Time Lords are kind of the same, that they kind of mimic actions. That doesn't bother me so much. And we're in a new reality now too. I thought the performance was good. She seems more the Rani than Mrs. Flood, who seems quite an odd character as the Rani.
Well, and she's completely, put herself under the other one's thumb, right? And so, like, that doesn't feel very Ronnie-like to me. I don't know. But unless she's running an agenda, and again, that's always the problem. We analyze these things, but in 2 weeks, everything we've said might be moot, right? Something has come out in the next chapter that answers or addresses these things, right? It's definitely possible. But no, that's the feeling I have. One feels very Ronnie-like, and the other doesn't to me. And I'm like, well, and so it's like, is there a hierarchical structure in by generation that one becomes dominant and then the other recedes?
I don't know. I mean, you did feel a bit of that with the bioregeneration, which you'll have to watch and see. I mean, there are some arguments out there that the Tennant Doctor's dead by this point. I know Davis said that he quite liked the idea because he'd had so many people asking for him to come back. It's like, why, in my mind, I'm just going to kill him off, and thus stop that situation. And there is certainly an argument when you've got something like this, is your brain is automatically, well, what's the Tennant Doctor doing? Because that is, he's still technically, well, I'm spoiling it for you, but you've had 2 years to learn this, he's still about.
Yes, yeah, no,
So,
I know what kind of happened from just reading.
did you find, how do you feel about Omega? I knew it was going to be, funnily enough, at the beginning of this episode, as soon as they said the looking for the one, I just knew it was going to be Omega. And I was kind of disappointed there was, in a sense.
I don't know. Sometimes I don't know exactly how to say it.
But should we be disappointed? Because this, I mean, you just talked about for the last hour the tradition of Doctor Who, and surely the reoccurrence of villains, as with Marvel or DC, is a staple part of it.
It's absolutely legitimate. For me, I wonder if there are enough it's a lot like the Rani. It's like that, like I think she was a really neat villain. I think Omega was a really neat villain, but is there enough there to characterize him, to be building him up to be this thing? Like, what do we really like? What are the characteristics there that we're like? We sort of always know with Cybermen, and there's something terrifying about them. And you know, the in the Capaldi era, and they came back to their Mondas form, which was even more terrifying, right? There's a set of characteristics about them that you know immediately what it is, and it emotionally impacts you. What is that with Omega? I can't say, you know, because in America we say Omega, right? It's Omega, right? Omega, is that how you're saying it? Okay, right? Okay, excuse me, sorry. Lost in translation there. But I don't know that there's enough there to make the journey meaningful. Like, right? I mean, he's a villain, but is he a personality?
And it also feels, and this is Doctor Who's been doing this for a while now, certainly since Doomsday, is if you produce your chess piece, you produce your king, you put them on the board, and then the next episode, the final episode, you produce another king and you put it on the board. Where do they fit?
Right. How do they fit together? And so, you know, I'm not sure. I'm not sure that the season even needs that. Why? Yes. Right? Why do we have to? Is it? And again, I'm perfectly willing to admit, and I'm not going to say it's not justified, because as you said, they market, they're making the show. Is it that we need that hit? Did we need that adrenaline hit of, ooh, this is coming and it's somebody else? It's like the Ronnie gave us an adrenaline hit, but now it's time for the next adrenaline hit. And, you know, and so it's more about that buzz we get than the actual story, because as I said, these stories are filled with ideas and they're almost all underdeveloped. They're all undercooked.
Do you think some of it's to do with, I mean, Davis has sort of said that half of this has been planned. I think the Rani was planned from the beginning, that Gatwa was like, I would like the Rani. And he was like, oh, I'm going to do the Rani. Right. I think, where did he say that he met Carol Ann Ford? It was one of the screenings, and sort of asked her to come back. And so a lot of these things have obviously been in play for a while, that he's been planning since the beginning, since he started taking over again. Is there a sort of sense of this is a writer who is, as a human being, edging their bet that their big finale, you know, when you think, I mean, as a writer yourself, you think too, you're planning something which is going to not transpire on television for 2.5 years or so. Do you start over big? Do you over ramp that from the get go? Because you're thinking that you know, you're obviously wanting to, in your head, have a framework of something big as that final thing. But in the sense, when you get there, you realize actually, if this story had just been about him fighting a villain and Susan was in it, that would be big enough. Or if it's just him and the Rani going head to head, that would be enough. That's big. Do we enough. Need Omega, Rani, Susan, Mel?
Right. So I'm going to say, as a writer, I'm very suspicious of writers who announce that they have a plan and that they're going to follow a plan and that this was all the plan the whole time.
Yes, you know, fair enough. Yep.
You know, I got burned by Battlestar Galactica. And they told us every week the Cylons had a plan. So the Cylons had no freaking plan. You know.
To be fair, though, Ron Moore did always say from the beginning there was no plan. Literally, they had no idea, even in the pilot, that they were going to be using what characters in the series. So, but I mean, Lost is a very famous one. Well, I suppose Lost is the same as the mystery box, the Abrams mystery box.
Yes. You know, so that doesn't mean you don't have, okay. So yeah, it's like, how do you define plan, right? It's like, do you have, is your plan that you want to bring back the Rani and then bring back somebody else, but you don't know how you're going to do it? Or do you assiduously map point A to point B to point C? And point D is the Rani and point E is Omega, right? You know, so what are we talking about in terms of plan? Because like, I believe in the former and not the latter. I believe like an intention is to bring a person back and to have them be the villain, but like how you actually get there, like you don't really know. Because I mean, I'll be honest, that tends to be much more writerly and how I write. Like I know what I want to happen. And then I start writing and it's like,
I
still happens, but in a really different way than what I thought it was going to happen.
I can see in a lot of Davis's writing, I've seen it in Moffat's as well, but certainly in Davis's writing, what I call shower moments, where you're in the shower thinking of your story and there's a scene that comes into your head and you go, that scene then pivots and stuff starts connecting to that moment. I was
Right.
thinking, you haven't seen the end of the previous season, but there's a moment there which is just to me a shower scene where you've just gone, that's how it that's going to be the thing which sort of pulls it together. And I see a lot of that in Davis's writing where you feel like this is a moment he's gone, that's brilliant. I love that idea. It's brilliant. And but so I imagine, and I could be wrong, that he's had a few ideas of the Rani or Omega in a
Right.
scene at the end of the show, but it's not written yet, but it'll be
Yes.
brilliant and
Right.
that's got to happen. But ultimately, if you're able to do things without that sort of pressure of advertising, commercial success, ratings, and you were just writing a story, would especially him, who's written a lot of work which isn't about the world exploding, whether it's a scene, queer as folk, it would perhaps be something more, it would be something less packed and
Right.
more about people.
Right. Because, so the up and down of the shower moment. So sometimes those shower moments are brilliant, and other times they are the kill your darlings moment. You know that phrase is I think it was Stephen King who said, like, if there's some scene you're really attached to, for some reason, like kill it, kill your darling, because maybe it doesn't belong. And I think in
PJ
Doctor.
Harvey used to say the same thing about music. If there's a hook that
Okay.
you kill your favorite hook, I think.
Yeah. And so for me, Doctor Who is kind of about 50-50 on that. I think some of the things end up not being all they're built up to be because they fell in love with their darling and what they needed to do was kill that darling. And other times it's the shower moment that it is worth building to. But to me, it's only, and listen, I don't know that any other show is better, but it's got maybe about a 50% success rate, between balancing those. Like, oh gosh, I'm not even gonna say it. I don't want to diminish anybody or any character. I just don't know why you bring back Mel and then to have her do what she did in Wish World, and that's like the outcome of it. It's like, wow, we brought back Mel for,
She was in the back end of last series as well, to be fair.
Yeah, I do know that. I knew she came back, right. And I'm sure she had a more significant part there, but it's like, but now you bring her back so she can look out the window and, I don't know.
I'm assuming she will meet the Rani, since obviously time and the Rani,
Right. History.
there will be a connection. There
Absolutely.
will be some sort of history like they did with Sarah and Davros.
Right.
But yeah, so in a sense, this is a hard one for us to comment on because it's one part of a two-part story, essentially.
Right. We don't know how it ends yet. So everything we say might be moot.
It might be, might be, it might be. But yeah, okay. So I think we've pretty much covered everything about Wishworld for the time being, and we'll be interested to see where it goes next week. Just before we finish off, just sort of say sort of stuff that you're doing at the moment, and let people know what Muir's up to in the world.
Watching Doctor Who again. But thank you, James. Right. So what I've been working on recently is a low budget independent web series called Abnormal Fixation. It's about a paranormal investigator who's very hapless, named Elvis Bragg, who's entered a contest. $250,000 he'll get if he can prove the existence of the paranormal. And it's structured as a mockumentary. And his nemesis, if he loses, he'll have to pay $250,000 to this debunking agency called Skeptica. But the personal side of it is that his wife has left him for the debunking organization CEO. So there's personal stakes and there's, the actual stakes of proving the paranormal. And Abnormal Fixation, we're very lucky. It's won a bunch of awards. We've just gotten online distribution. You can find it right now, the first six episodes on YouTube. We're about ready to start shooting the second six episodes. It is comedy horror. It's like kind of skirts the line between mockumentary and found footage. And there's definitely those two forms are really related. So that's sort of what it plays with. And then I hope My next book, Horror Films, the 2010s, it's in the hands of my publisher, McFarland, and I hope it will be out before too long.
Excellent. And we've been meaning, I remember the last time we talked, it was that book that we were going to do some stuff. Maybe right. We should do that in future and have a chat about.
I'd love it.
About horror in the 2010s and the fun that is in there. Okay. That was a particularly poor sentence. Right. Yeah. So we'll put a link to your work in the show notes. That will go in. It's been great to catch up. We'll probably do some more stuff with John. Because John, I've always enjoyed talking to you. You'll find his books online. You've done many books, including one on Doctor Who.
That's right.
You'll find them sometimes in the library. I have, which is always great to see. And yeah, it's a fast. And do you still do your blog? I've not checked in ages.
I do. It's not as much. I mean, I cover news about our web series, Abnormal Fixation. I tend to do more anniversaries, like, for instance, the important day in this season, May 24th, was actually the 40th anversary of View to a Kill, the last Roger Moore James Bond movie.
Of course, so that's where you're going.
Right. So that's it. So I reviewed that yesterday, you know. So I'm doing some reviews, but it's, you know, talk about a way to sell it to get people to go. It's not what it was, you know, 10 years ago. So I still do post, but not as frequently and not as much material for sure.
The final thing I'm just going to add is something which one of my colleagues, Magnus, sent to me this morning was the Mirror has apparently said that their inside source says that the BBC will carry on with Doctor Who even if Disney decides not to do series 3 and 4, which I think is an interesting space to be in, because we've been talking a lot in these podcast series about whether this kind of is it for Doctor Who, in terms of if it can't make what Disney makes, if it can't sort of make that step into the commercial sphere, what does the public service do with it? So it sounds like it might carry on, although it still feels like this might be the last, next week might be the last Nchuti Gatwa Doctor Who, by quite likely. So we'll be interested to see where that goes as well. Are you going to be watching next week?
Oh, you bet. Well, now I'm back in it, aren't I? Every time I try to get out, you drag me back in. Doctor Who drags me back in.
I don't know. I mean, people say, oh, you're such a Doctor Who fan. I think I don't ever think of myself as a Doctor Who fan. I talk a lot about it, but there's so many things out there to be a fan of these days. It's right. It's hard to pick any specific one out. But
well,
yeah,
I want to thank you. You know, because I don't think I would have had the courage to go back to it without knowing I had this date to do this, right? Because again, I had this sort of emotional thing to say, oh, you know, I associate it now with my son being little and that, you know, magical time in our lives. It's like, and now I'm going back without him with me there. And it was just too hard. So thank you, you know, because I got over that now and I can watch Doctor Who.
I suppose the beautiful thing, though, is with Doctor Who is because the formula is quite literally regenerative, I can't say it, regenerates.
Right.
You can sort of carry an era with a certain sense of meaning and then move into a different era. And that era can kind of have its own sense of meaning without it feeling too tied.
That's right. And that's what my wife said to me. She said, John, you know, he's going to go to college and he's going to move out and you and I can still enjoy things. So I think she's right.
Well, I hope that's the case. And hopefully there will be more Doctor Who for years to come in some form or another. That's it for this week. Next week, I'm not sure what the guests will have for next week, but next week's the final one. And we will speak soon.